Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Mark Twain, whose death has been greatly exaggerated for a century. We're going to try to use his words tonight to celebrate the 100th anniversary of his death, and we've invited people in the audience here and the live audience at the Commonwealth Club to share portions of what they found very, very entertaining about Mark Twain's writings, and that is how we're going to start today. Unfortunately, we don't have anybody that can ask questions directly of him after that's over, but other than the question period, we'll do that, and then as I said, I will talk a little bit about Mark Twain, give a little bit of background, et cetera. So who would like to go first? Nobody. Okay, I'll start. One of my favorite quotes by Mark Twain is deceptively simple, and we can talk about it a little bit. It has to do with the Bible. He said, "Adam didn't want the apple for its own sake. He wanted the apple only because it was forbidden. The mistake lay in not forbidding him to eat the snake." That's one of those things that you can think about it, and you know, because it mentioned this thing about anti-authoritarianism. You know, the person, obviously, who made the "you shall not eat the apple" law is supposed to be omniscient. So where's the mistake? It's a real mistake. We can all figure out right away. Either the intention was for people to leave the garden, or the intention was not, you know, if they wanted him to stay, all he had to do was say, "eat the snake." And he would have been, you know, and being omniscient, he would have known. They would have gone and eat the snake. So it is very funny, but it's also undercutting a very prime idea in our culture. And he kind of, That one made it out during his lifetime because it's not so obvious. He made other things as funny, but much more obvious. So we'll get back to some of that later. It's not all Tom Sawyer, although Tom Sawyer was anti-authoritarian, as you very well know. And at the end of Huck Finn, what happens? You know, his aunt wants to civilize him. He says, "I can't take any civilizing. I'm heading out to the territories." So this is a very common theme through the children's literature all the way to, I mean, those of you who don't know, the last 10 years of his life, he was extremely well known for taking on very large targets and cutting them down to size with his pen, including the King of Belgium, who owned the Congo and was torturing people in order to take the diamonds out and stuff like that. And Twain hit him with a broadside that made him stop doing it. He also took on the Tsar of Russia in 1907, which is why the Russians and the communists liked him throughout the entire time that they didn't like anything American other than Jack London. Those of you who know Jack London from this story know why. And Mark Twain, because Mark Twain took on the Tsar and had him, something called, a very short piece, but it's called the Tsar's Soliloquy. And the Tsar is standing in front of his mirror naked, talking about how he rules these hundreds of millions of souls that do whatever he wants. And he just cuts the whole idea of monarchy to shreds. So, but he puts it into the Tsar's own words. So, of course, the communists who just 10 years later did that to the Tsar, cut him into shreds, thought that that's, you know, that Mark Twain was an acceptable thing to read. And I actually have a couple of books while I was in Russia in 1973, and I got a couple of books in Russian, Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn, although it's Guckleberry Finn in Russian. So, who would like to go second? Yes. Ah. Okay, we'd like you to talk into the microphone. If you want to sit there, that's okay.
I'll bring the microphone to you because that might be a little more comfortable. Because this is being recorded, my voice carries, but we want to make sure that everything goes up. Hannibal,
Missouri.
From Elmira as well, which I'll mention.
Well, one of the things I learned when I was growing up, that there's this sense of Mark Twain all through Hannibal. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up and I left, I realized that the grown men in the town had a very dry sense of humor, mm-hmm. that I missed when I left Hannibal. But one of the expressions that was kind of around was, you sent your damn fools to St. Louis because they got lost in the crowd, mm-hmm. and people thought they were really cool. But the ones in Hannibal knew them for what they were.
Right.
And I finally read recently Life on the Mississippi uh-huh. and found that's where it had come from.
That's where it comes from, yeah.
That was something that we just said. It was part of the milieu of growing up there. And also that we always would notice that the Russians would always come to Hannibal to visit Mark Twain's hometown.
Right. Right.
And that was when they didn't do a great job necessarily in getting tourists there, but the Russians always came.
Yeah. It's amazing how popular he is, and it's not just because he was against the Tsar. It's amazing how popular his writing is in Russia. But one of the other things about Russia is, I mean, they have monuments to their writers and to other individual poets and stuff like that. They kind of take it seriously, although don't know if that survived the fall of communism. Next. Or should I tell a story about Hannibal? All right, you've got one? Okay, great.
This is a bit from his book, A Tramp Abroad, which has always fascinated me, especially since I went to Germany and found that he was completely right about this. It's called The Skeleton for a Black Forest Novel. And I've shortened it and modified it a little bit, tried to keep the flavor of the way he wrote. Rich old farmer named Huss has inherited a great wealth of manure and by diligence has added to it. It is double-starred in Baedeker. The Black Forest artist paints it, his masterpiece. The king comes to see it. Paul Hoke is a suitor for his daughter Gretchen's hand, ostensibly. He really wants the manure. Hoke has a good many cartloads of the Black Forest currency himself and is therefore a good catch. But he is sordid, mean, and without sentiment, whereas Gretchen is all sentiment and full of poetry. Hans Schmidt, full of sentiment, full of poetry, loves Gretchen, and Gretchen loves him. But he has no manure. Old Huss forbids him his house. His heart breaks. He goes away to die, for he says bitterly, "What is a man without manure?" Hans returns and says, "I wandered in the solitude of the forest, longing for death but finding none. Digging 3 days agone, I struck a manure mine, a Golconda, a limitless bonanza of solid manure."
For those of you who aren't aware also, I mean, Mark Twain was really quite a traveler. There are pieces of his life all over the whole world. And one of the things he did in our area in San Francisco was he was a gold miner, silver miner. He came out to Virginia in the early 1860s and then ended up in San Francisco. He was also a writer or a journalist, but he got in trouble on a regular basis with the police for the things that he wrote. And then he would have to hightail out of town and hole up with some of his friends up in the mining territory. And it was by being holed up in the mining territory that he heard somebody tell a story about the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which he then turned into the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. And that was in the papers out here, got picked up by the New York papers, and everybody in New York wanted to hear who was this guy. That was how he got his start. So San Francisco gave Mark Twain his start. But you can travel almost anywhere. Hawaii, there's a tree that Mark Twain apparently planted when he was there in Hawaii, because when he was in San Francisco, he was sent to Hawaii, which was the Sandwich Islands at the time, to report on what was going on there. And apparently one of the things he did was plant one of those really big trees, I mean, at this time. So 100 years later, 150 years later, they still have that tree. Of course, you know, the actual one blew down about 50 years ago. And they just took the sign and moved it to the next one, which I'm sure he'd be entertained by. So Hannibal, might talk about Hannibal for a second. That's... I wrote my short story, Mark Twain's Visit to Heaven, right after I visited Hannibal in 1978, so quite a while ago. But I took some of my young siblings with me, and we went to Hannibal and camped out near the cave, which was the basis of the stories in Tom Sawyer about Injun Joe in the caves and so on. And then we were in town, so we visited Hannibal in 78. We were one of the tourists. And afterwards I wrote a story called Mark Twain's Visit to Heaven. And it is a story about Mark Twain dying, so today, 100 years ago, and then realizing he wasn't dead, which surprised him. And then he went to heaven, and it was exactly the way he said it couldn't possibly be. And he was very irritated by this in the story. And so he's given a harp and some wings and a halo and sent up onto a choir loft with another 3 billion angels and told to start singing. So he starts singing, and within about a day, he gets too bored to last. And so he begins to try to cause problems. So he starts to sing off key, starts to do other things to entertain the people around him. The people around him are entertained by it, you know. So he gets going, and finally can't stand it anymore, and he trips, and he falls down the whole choir loft and knocks everybody, you know, half the people over, and everybody ends up all down on the cloud. And he gets kicked out of heaven and said that, you know, there hasn't been a fall in heaven like this since Satan. And then Archangel Gabriel, who showed him in, starts to take him someplace else. And he says, I assume you're taking me to hell. And he says, well, you know, what is hell? And he said, you know, bored to tears. And he says, well, where do you think you just were? I won't tell you the rest of the story, but that's the way the story starts. So that Mark Twain figures out he said, we figure we'd punish you by pretending that this is exactly what heaven was like. What you said it wouldn't be, couldn't be. So next, who's wants to? I'm sure. Here, how about you?
All right, you asked for it.
Good. We want it.
Okay, this is for a piece entitled About Magnanimous Incident Literature. It's one of Twain's late essays. It's kind of a piece, though, of his earlier stories. The story of the bad little boy, who, of course, makes good. The story of the good little boy, who, of course, gets blown to bits and so on. But anyway, Twain begins. Many times I wish that the charming anecdotes had not stopped with their happy climaxes. That's when, you know, you do really good, great things when you help other people. But it continued the pleasing history of the several benefactors and beneficiaries. He starts out with an anecdote called The Grateful Poodle. The Grateful Poodle has a broken leg. The doctor fixes it. The Grateful Poodle brings a friend with a dog. Friend dog to the doctor. The doctor again fixes the broken leg and so on. The kind physician at once relieved the distressed animal, nor did he forget to admire the inscrutable goodness and mercy of God, who had been willing to use so humble an instrument as the poor outcast poodle for the inculcating of, etc., etc., etc. But then Twain, you know, says, but this is the real story. He multiplies the dogs, of course. You know, not two dogs, not four dogs, 16 dogs, 32 dogs. The good physician hired a couple of assistant surgeons and got through his benevolent work before dark, first taking the precaution to cancel his church membership so that he might express himself with the latitude which the case required. But some things have their limits. When once the morning dawned and the good physician looked out upon a mass and far-reaching multitude of clamorous and beseeching dogs, he said, I might as well acknowledge it. I have been fooled by the books. They only tell the pretty part of the story and then stop. Fetch me the shotgun. This thing has gone along far enough. He issued forth with his weapon and chanced to step upon the tail of the original poodle, who promptly bit him in the leg. Now, the great and good work which this poodle had been engaged in had engendered in him such a mighty and augmenting enthusiasm as to turn his weak head at last and drive him mad. A month later, when the benevolent physician lay in the death throes of hydrophobia, he called his weeping friends about him and said, beware of the books. They tell but half of the story. Whenever a poor wretch asks you for help, and you feel a doubt as to what result may flow from your benevolence, give yourself the benefit of the doubt and kill the applicant. And so saying, he turned his face to the wall and gave up the ghost. You know, anybody who feels put upon, by the way, by the American work ethic would really, really enjoy Mark Twain, I think. And by the way, may I just suggest, anybody who would like to track Twain studies would be cordially welcomed at the American Literature Association conference, which is going to be held from May 27th through 30th at the San Francisco Hyatt. And again, you know, they may ask you for a small fee, but the Twain people are noted for welcoming everybody. And indeed, it's not just us academics. You know, we really would like to have larger participation. But anyway, this is my contribution for anybody who feels a little bit put upon and overworked. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to say something about that conference, too. Thanks for bringing it up, because there have been two new biographies that came out with the latest. And one of them is called Mark Twain, The Other Woman. And the other one is called Mark Twain, Man in White. And the first one's by Laura Trombley, I think. And the second one's by Michael Sheldon. Laura Trombley is president of Pritzker College down in the Claremont area of California, and Michael Sheldon is at Indiana State University. Well, they're totally opposite books upon the same subject, and fascinating as a result. I just read both of them. And Michael Sheldon's book, Mark Twain, Man in White. Okay, well, before I spoil, they're both going to be on the same panel at this conference, which should be interesting all by itself. But it's March 27th, Michael told me. It's March 27th from 9 o'clock in the morning.
May 27th.
Thank you very much. May 27th. It's the first one in the morning, I think 9 a.m. to 10:30 or something like that. And there's four people on the panel, but these two are both on the same panel on purpose, of course, to create fireworks. But before I talk about that, before I give a little bit more detail, I wanted to ask a question. What is your image of Mark Twain's last 4 or 5 years? What do you think of when you think of Mark Twain and how he's been presented, what the basic imagery is? What's your basic image? How many think of him, anybody want to say out loud?
Savage.
Okay. Anybody else?
Angry curmudgeon,
exactly. Anybody else?
Four.
Okay. Four.
You
want to come home from Europe? Yeah, that's right. Want to come home from Europe? All right.
Yes. You just enjoy talking.
You enjoy talking. Okay, that's a very good one. All right. Now, the angry curmudgeon comes from Justin Kaplan and Van Wyck Brooks, and Michael Sheldon, the author of Mark Twain, Man in White, very subtly blasts their theory out of the water. He definitely was sad. I mean, his life story was, you know, that he had lost his wife about 7 years before he died. She was in her 50s. He had already lost before that an infant son who was 2 years old when he died, first child. His oldest daughter died at the age of 24 from meningitis when he was in London traveling around the world speaking to make back money. And he had two daughters left, and the one of them had epilepsy. The other one was a musician, a singer, Clara. And the younger one who had epilepsy died on Christmas Eve of his last year in 2009. So he had lost his wife, two daughters, and a son, and, you know, that will make you sad. So definitely sad at times. But he himself said, I can't help myself. Within a certain amount of time, I'm cheerful again. That's my nature. I can't help myself. And if you read a lot of his writing from that time, a lot of it is extremely cheerful, although it's cheerful in a way which most people can't comprehend. How can you be cheerful about some depressing subjects? But he was taking on these authority figures and having a very good time of it. And that's a very fascinating thing about the end of his life. And I have not read a better description of his last 5 or 6 years. One of the things that one of the authors about 20 years ago, Hamlin Hill, some of you will know, he wrote a book called Mark Twain, God's Fool. And Mark Twain said that he was God's fool, you know, so that wasn't like, he used his words. He tried to make him seem like an angry old curmudgeon too, but he also hinted that maybe Mark Twain was a pedophile, you know. Yeah, that was at the end of his book. And, you know, it was a charge because at the end, last 5 years of his life, he made friends with a lot of 12-year-old to 15-year-old girls because he didn't have any grandchildren. So they don't have any granddaughters. You know, I don't have any grandchildren. He had three girls. He'd always enjoyed it. So he made friends with them. He was chaperoned the whole time and all that. But there was one story that he left the house, you know, in Bermuda, and maybe it was because they had a 15-year-old daughter, and there was some, you know, he just hinted at it. But this Michael Sheldon blows that theory out of the water. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. And that Mark Twain left because he was dying, you know, and he went right home and died. So it probably was too big a burden for that family. The family had liked him so much they invited him to stay, but he stayed for 3 months the last time he went to Bermuda, and he was dying. I'm sure that was a pretty big burden on the family. So the reason he left was to go home to die, not because there was some problem with this. But people have been hinting about this with the angelfish. He called them angelfish. He had an aquarium at home, and he put up pictures of all of his girls around it, so on and so forth, all of his girlfriends. And he wrote them hundreds of letters. And every single one of them wrote very nicely about, you know, their relationship with this grandfatherly guy, you know, 30, 40 years later. So there was no reason to do that, but I imagine it got Hamlin Hill his PhD or a job someplace. So that's one thing that he takes down, which I was happy about. But the other thing that he shows is that during those last few years, he was extremely popular with all kinds of people. You know, that there were a lot of famous men. I mean, sometimes people say, well, he just spent time with little girls. No, he spent most of the time with men. But he also had a lot of, in New York, he lived right outside of New York, he had a lot of fans among the leading actresses of the day, including Billy Burke was a friend of his. And she went to visit him on the weekend. Billy Burke, who knows who Billy Burke is? Okay, who can say what was her last role that made her famous? She was in The Wizard. She played the Good Witch. The Good Witch. But she was a 20-year-old actress at the time who just made it on Broadway and was an upcoming Broadway star. And she was a friend of his, and she came out to visit. And one of the Barrymores came out to visit all the time. One of the Barrymore actresses, you know, were in their teens, late teens, and so on. So he had a lot of famous, beautiful women around as well after his wife died, who also just said that, you know, he treated them very nicely. He didn't treat them as anything other than very fascinating people to talk to. But he found almost everybody fascinating to talk to, and that's why your comment before. He just talked and talked and talked. And he went around and had a lot of fun conversations with a lot of top people. He met George Bernard Shaw when he went over to England. He got an honorary doctorate from Oxford, and George Bernard Shaw wanted to meet him. But they didn't realize it, but I guess one of the guys that was coming, the biographer of George Bernard Shaw happened to be on the same train as Mark Twain was coming into London. And so George Bernard Shaw was on the track to meet his biographer, and Mark Twain stepped up. And Mark Twain knew the biographer from something else, some other meeting, and so that's how they got introduced. And then they spent, he hadn't planned on it, but they spent a couple of afternoons together chatting about things. So, and one of his other friends was Henry Rogers, who was right after Rockefeller, one of the Standard Oil tycoons that Roosevelt was trying to take down. But he also had helped Twain recover his finances and had been friends for 15 or 20 years with him. And they played pirates together when they were in their 70s. So they went off to Bermuda and goofed off as if they were pirates. And Twain was always joking, well, he's the real pirate, because that was his reputation as a Standard Oil tycoon. So they played very nice jokes these are a couple stories from Mark Twain, Man and Wife, but they played jokes to Henry Huddleston. Henry Rogers was actually ill, so his friend Twain wanted to bring him to Bermuda and have him help him recover and get him away from New York for a little while, because he was under pressure because Standard Oil was trying to be broken up by the trust busters and so on. And so he tried to sneak him out of town, but when they got on the boat to sail, all the reporters were there because they'd gotten wind that Mark Twain was going to sail, and they found out Henry Rogers was going to be on too. So they had a joke routine that kept the reporters at, you know, off kilter the whole time until the ship left, so they didn't have to really answer any questions about the lawsuits or anything. But these were his friends. He was invited to about five events a day for the last 4 or 5 years of his life in New York City. So he didn't obviously attend them all, but he attended a large number. including lots of charity events where he helped out all kinds of different charities get raise money and stuff like that. So he was the Belle of New York, as they called him in the papers, not a sad, depressed, grumpy old curmudgeon. Like a lot of people, when he wasn't feeling good, he wrote down what was really making him mad, and then he walked away from it and was happy again. And therefore, those writings are there. Another part of it that gave that impression is that, a lot of the writings at that time, he was angry at divine authority, and therefore, a lot of people who don't think you should ever get mad at divine authority thought he was a grumpy old man, but actually, it's very funny stuff if you if you're on the other divide of that one. So, one of the stories, just to give you an idea, one of the stories he did not want published, that was, I think, published by the University of California Press from their collection 15 years ago, something like that. They didn't have to wait for the 100 years for this one, is a story about Jesus being born to a young teenage girl in Missouri, and then for the second coming, and then he gets his apostles around him, and then he's asked to make the weather better, to grow better crops in Missouri. And so he does that. And then that causes a problem someplace else. So those people come to him and say, well, change the weather. You have to change it back. You've ruined it for us. So he changes it back. Then somebody else says, but you have to change it over here. So he changes it again. And then because of all the unusual changes in the weather, everyone gets sick. So then the people say, you have to make sure that we're not sick. Cure us of our ills. So he cures everybody of all their illnesses, and then the undertakers are mad. And so on. So it's a very, very funny unpublished story, but I can see why he probably didn't want it published at the time. I mean, to put it out at the time, because it really sort of also makes the fundamental comment, like the other one is, if this is the way things are, the way we've experienced them for thousands of years, human life is this way. If it wasn't intended to be this way, it wouldn't be this way. If there was somebody who makes it this way. If there's nobody that makes it this way, then it's our mess that we make. No. So it's either one or the other. It's not that somehow we tricked him. Of course, one really interesting element of that is how everybody deals with this issue. I'll give you a good example. I use this from a lot of things when I talk about how we think about ourselves. And I'm going to read something a little bit later. My reading is from The Mysterious Stranger. And which is also right at the end of his life, and very entertaining about the most difficult subjects. And he turned it into a children's story, which is just about unbelievable. But in any case, the attempts that he made, to describe these issues, I think are the most cheerful attempts to undercut these ideas that have ever been put forward. And I think if you look at him as a thinker, as a philosopher, which his family did, they said, this is actually greatest skill. And most of the people that talked to him said, he was a philosopher, he was working on this idea, and he was a man who really loved free will, obviously, and anti-authoritarian and everything, but he couldn't come up with the logic in having this divine authority unless we really are just puppets of that, and that everything is determined. And so he was struggling with this idea between determinism and free will. And that really was what drove a lot of his ideas for the last 10 years. He didn't come to a really good conclusion on it, but he made a lot of fascinating comments about it. So I think that's another thing that he was working on quite often at the end of his life, trying to solve the puzzle that no one solved. So not too surprising he didn't either. You had something you wanted to say.
Yeah. You mentioned two books.
Okay, so I talked about, you're right. That was Mark Twain, Man in White. So as I said, that's the best biography, certainly of his last years, I have read, and I've read almost all of them. The other book is called Mark Twain, The Other Woman. And this is a fascinating book because of how inaccurately used the information is. The basic story is that Mark Twain had a secretary, he had a lot of assistants at the end of his life. Had a secretary quite often, but he had a secretary that came to help the family and help him with things, but helped his wife when she was in the last 2 years of her life. Things started to work for him in 1901, 1902. Her name is Isabel Lyon. And she was quite effective as a helper. And then she ended up running his household as time went by, and unbeknownst to him was fantasizing in her diaries about marrying him and becoming the next wife. Well, this professor, president of Pritzker College, Laura Trombley, has taken her side for about 15 or 20 years and assumed that this was all true information and that this was really, you know, his secret lover and so on and so forth. Not to mention he was, you know, like 69 years old at the time and had been devoted to his wife. And even in spite of the fact that Isabel Lyon in her diary said, no, when asked about this, said, no, he only loved his wife. He will never love another woman, period. But that doesn't stop her from, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, if Jimmy Stewart's secretary, you know, went to the National Enquirer and tried to put out things about the fact that pretty soon he's going to divorce his wife and marry me. It's that kind of thing for the time. And this professor takes it very seriously. I could mention a lot of examples where she quotes out of context, but I will mention one. Because so few people know this material that it's hard to believe, actually. But and it's also a good example of Twain's robust humor. So I hope no one's shocked by this. But it actually comes from the 1860s when he was only in his early 30s. And the professor, this is how the professor states it in a paragraph. She says something about just before he married his wife, you know, he was a Westerner and a wild Westerner, and everyone has been arguing about, you know, how pure he was and everything, all that kind of stuff, which is sort of unnecessary. Obviously, he was a robust character. But anyway, she says in this paragraph something like this. Well, as we all know, Mark Twain was a faithful user of odorless condoms in his early 30s. And then she quotes from the article, from a letter that he had written to a friend of his in 1868 or so, that said, you know, please send me a dozen of your famous odorless, you know, condoms. I don't care that they're odorless. I'll supply the odor myself. and period. So that was the quotation. Okay, I happen to have the original. I'm not the original, but I have the letters, a book with all those letters in it. So I looked up the letter to see what was actually in the letter. Well, it was a letter to his friend Frank Fuller, who had been, I think, one of the top officials in the territory of Nevada when he had come out to Nevada. So he knew him as somebody from the early 60s, 1860s, out here. And Frank Fuller had either been in charge of the territory or whatever, so he came back. That Frank Fuller had gone back to New York at the time, and Twain was doing tours talking about Innocents Abroad, his first book, giving lectures. You know, this was before television. He was a very big hit on the lecture circuit. He was a stand-up comedian, basically. And he would travel around giving talks about these things, and that's what he was doing at the time when he sent this letter to Frank. And it was an old buddy of his, and his old buddy had just bought a rubber goods company in New York that made the tops of buggies, made a whole bunch of other things, but one of the things they made was condoms. And so he was teasing him about this because if you read, you know, it was mostly about something else. And then the last paragraph was, oh, and also, Frank, you know, please send me a dozen of your famous, you know, odorless, you know, condoms. You know, and he put the line in about, you know, I'll supply the order himself. And the next line was, I'd really appreciate it if you send me the kind with your picture on it. Yeah. Now, she deleted that, you know, from her quotation. And if that's not a joke, and that's an intentional use of a clear joke to try to create an image which is inaccurate about the man. And the book is filled with that. And that's really, you know, she obviously had the next line. And it's pretty hard to believe it's anything other than a joke under those circumstances. But she turned that into a faithful user. That's, you know, that's academic ability. So anyway, she's going to be on the panel along with this other guy who obviously disagrees with her misuse of that material. But she has there's a tremendous amount of material from the secretary that she left behind. And this professor who wrote the book about the other woman is one of the few who's read most of that material. But she, when she was mad, she pulled a trick on Twain, which was very uncomfortable at the end of her, right near the end of his life. She was keeping his daughter, who had epilepsy, away because she was afraid of that daughter, and she was telling the doctor one thing. She was telling the doctor that Twain was afraid of her, and she was telling Twain that the doctor said she couldn't go. So she was lying and kept the daughter away from home when she could have been at home for 2 years. That would irritate almost anybody. So he got irritated at her when he found that out, but he didn't know. And so he fired her. And after the firing, she was putting a lot of information out to the New York Times the way you would do to the National Enquirer. And so that's the genesis of the whole thing. She was actually quite a competent woman in many ways, but at the end of her period of time with him, she drank too much and so on and so forth. So it's a sad story, and she was probably a pretty good woman, but there's a lot of conclusions that are drawn by this professor that are way, way, way out of line. So now, next, yeah.
Just a couple of footnotes to what you've been saying. First of all, there is also a new biography out from the University of California Press by Jerome Loving, L-O-V-I-N-G. I haven't been able to get my hands on it from the library. I probably will have to break down and buy it, as a matter of fact. But Loving is a very, very respectable scholar who has written on Walt Whitman, among other things, and so on. So his biography is something to look for. I would also say Joyce Carol Oates has written a collection of fiction entitled Wild Nights. That's an allusion to Emily Dickinson. Unfortunately, the story that is Twain-oriented has to do with him and the angelfish, and I'm afraid that's going to, lend credence to the idea that Twain was somehow abusively connected with the young women and so on. It's well to remember that authors have their own agendas, yeah, and beware of creative writers appropriating each other's works. That's what I would say. So I'm looking for Loving. I've read Oates, but take Oates's story as fiction.
Yeah, and Mark Twain's been using fiction quite often, but the nice thing about the truth is that whatever anybody says about it doesn't make any difference. Never changes it. So that doesn't matter. I don't think it would matter to him. I think it would be pretty funny. But the other element, to the books that are out and the materials that are going to be produced is that, the tone of Twain's work is very clearly his tone. And that tone is something that you can see and feel and count on. And it's that exuberance and even innocence which he contained to his, boyish goofing off right up to his last, dying days, makes it pretty hard to believe those stories. But they, they sell. It sells. One of the things that is mentioned in Mark Twain and White, which I think is really quite good, was, the first biographies that were done. It's an interesting story of trying to control your image, because the daughter tried to control Mark Twain's image, and make sure that it was, as noble as it could be. Through the first 20, 30 years, and so only unauthorized biographies were written, and they had the first say, essentially, other than the official biographer, which was Albert Bigelow Payne, who knew him well. But the first one that did it was Justin Kaplan. He had this Freudian theory, and then Van Wyck Brooks had another angry curmudgeon, point of view. And fortunately, Willa Cather is quoted in Mark Twain and White, who said, I met Mark Twain when he was, in his last year of his life. And anybody who would have met him at 74 years of age holding forth court from his bed, talking to people, and the way he talked and everything would never have come up with such a stupid idea that that's how he finished off his life. So I think Willa Cather's, real quick denunciation of that, which was, a long time ago, is more effective than the other.
What happened to his daughter, his sole surviving daughter, who was the musician or singer or whatever?
Well, she married a man named Osip Gabrilowicz, who was a famous pianist at the time, had studied under Rachmaninoff, and was Russian. And he became head of the Detroit Symphony for 20 years, so they lived in Detroit for 20 years. And after he died, she actually moved out to Hollywood, lived in Hollywood. She was, a lot of money was coming in from movies about Mark Twain and everything, so the royalties were providing a good living for her. She had one daughter. That daughter died, committed suicide, I think, in her 50s. She had trouble because she had a extremely famous father who was Osip Gabrilowicz and an even more world-famous grandfather, and that seemed to cause her too much trouble. She, I think, died of overdose of alcohol. But the daughter that survived lived to be 88 years old, lived until 1962, something like that, and was responsible for making sure that For example, there's one of the people, you're from Elmira, right? That Elmira and Hartford, the Hartford home that they had lived in, Elmira, there are some things where that the aunt, the mother, Olivia, Mark Twain's wife, came from the Elmira area. And her sister still lived there, and there was a farm that they went to every summer called Nook Farm. And he did a lot of his writing, including Huckleberry Finn and other famous books there. So there's some, there's a writer's colony that's based on Mark Twain's money in Elmira. And then there's this Mark Twain Papers out here in California. So she made sure that there were two or three facilities like that. And was a funny lady. I mean, she made a lot of funny jokes about it.
The daughter
who lived to be 88. She's the one who made sure that everything got done the way she wanted. And some people thought she controlled a little bit too much, but, you know, she knew that he didn't want his writings, some of the writings, to be done for 100 years. Well, everybody that got to read them wanted them out right away. And some of them did come out in the 50s and 60s and so on and so forth. But it's not going to be as controversial as he thought it was.
I have a passage from what's probably Mark Twain's best-known book, Huckleberry Finn. And it's about two-thirds of the way through the book. And Huck and Jim have been drifting down the river, Mississippi River, on their raft, and make excursions to the sides of the river and have all kinds of adventures and meet all kinds of nefarious people. And then, as they go further south, Jim is captured by a man who has seen a wanted poster for this fugitive slave, and he meets the identification of the slave. And so he is holding him in expectation of a $200 reward. And Huck doesn't really know what to do. "I about made up my mind to pray," he says, "and see if I couldn't try to quit being the kind of boy I was and be better. So I kneeled down, but the words wouldn't come. Why wouldn't they? It weren't no use to try to hide it from him, nor from me neither. I knowed very well why they wouldn't come. It was because my heart weren't right. It was because I weren't square. It because I was playing double. I was letting on to give up sin, but away inside of me, I was holding on to the biggest one of all. I was trying to make my mouth say I would do the right thing and the clean thing and go and write to that nigger's owner and tell where he was. But deep down in me, I knowed it was a lie, and he knowed it. You can't pray a lie. I found that out. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea, and I says, I'll go and write the letter, and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing, the way I felt as light as a feather, right straight off, and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, 'Miss Watson, your runaway nigger Jim is down here 2 miles below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him, and he will give him up for the reward if you send. Huck Finn.' I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking how good it was all that this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell, and went on thinking, and got to thinking over our trip down the river, and I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me, so I could go on sleeping, and see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him in the swamp up there where the feud was, and such like times he would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard, and he was so grateful. And I said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world. and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was trembling because I'd got to decide forever between two things, and I noted. I studied a minute, short of holding my breath, and then says to myself, "All right, then, I'll go to hell," and tore it up.
It's great. That one page is the reason Mark Twain wrote that book.
I wish he would have ended it there.
Yeah, that's right. The ending, but that is exactly, there's no question, I think, in most people's mind. It was, that's the climax, and that is to try. I mean, a lot of people, of course, complain about the use of the word nigger and everything, which is understandable, but this was written in 1885, and finished in 1885, written over a five-year period, and what he was trying to do was change people's ideas in the most effective way he could about this issue, that these people are real people, and that this is, you know, this was obviously, I don't have to explain anymore, but this was what he aimed at in that book, and that's why that book is still so powerful, and why it'll be hard to get rid of it ever, even though we don't have the same problem anymore. We have similar problems always. Always humanity has similar problems, but that was a very severe version of it. So thank you very much, because I think that is the heart of you know, of the book that's considered his best, and that's the heart of it. Who else would like to share something?
Because I live,
my wife made him do things too, so
and I use these against her on a daily basis. Actually, they're I think life philosophies, and they're very famous. So I apologize if it insults anyone who really understands Twain better than I do. But the first one is, I've been through some terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened. And that's just great when you borrow trouble. The other one, which gets me in a lot of trouble when I'm about to head off on a trip for fly fishing in Brazil or whatever, is 20 years from now, you will more be disappointed by the things you didn't do than the ones you did. So throw off the bow lines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, and discover.
So then I say to him, well, not you don't have to wait 20 years. Tomorrow you'll be sorry. So... One thing I wanted to mention, which everyone might be well aware of, is about 5 years ago I selected Roughing It for my book club, and none of us had read it, and I hadn't either, and it's one of those books I avoided. And there was a chapter on the Nevada silver mine speculation that was spot on for the internet.com speculation at the time, around 2000-2001, and I was stunned. And I pointed it out to my group, and everyone was just kind of open jaw, said, "Oh my gosh, that's exactly how it was. It was the same sort of thing, which is, you know, buy a stock in the morning and sell it for triple the price at noon, and then, you know, it fell by 5 o'clock, et cetera, et cetera." And it was really, it was a great book, and that was a really good chapter.
Yeah, that's a. It's not quite as well known as Innocence Abroad, which at one point sold. Only second to the Bible in the United States, Innocence Abroad. But Roughing It was also a very big hit, because it also, another reason why Mark Twain is so famous is because he identified with different things in American culture. And people often talk about that, but what they really don't see is that the parts of his life that entertained him, he turned into American culture. I mean, living along the Mississippi River, going out west, traveling to Europe and making fun of those Europeans for being too staid, you know, and so on and so forth. That was a very big, that was a very unique Americanizing event for Europe, for Americans, because before that time, it was, you know, we were second best to the Europeans, and who would ever criticize those authorities? But there's a great bit, you know, one of the many bits from Innocence Abroad, which he repeated in many different ways over his lifetime, was he had a guide that would take them around to see all the Michelangelos, and after they had seen a few too many, they went around with a new guide. And the guide was showing them some Michelangelo, and they pretended they didn't know who he was. They said, "Michelangelo? Who? Michelangelo who? What was his last name? Is he dead?" That was their line from, "Is he dead yet?"
It happens that I brought a little tidbit from Roughing It, which is one of my favorite books. This is called A New Article of Diet. At the headwaters of the Jordan, remember this is a book about the West, but he's talking about his trip to the Middle East. A camel took charge of my overcoat while the tents were being pitched and examined it with a critical eye, all over with as much interest as if he had an idea of getting one made like it. Then, after he was done figuring on it as an article of apparel, he began to contemplate it as an article of diet. He put his foot on it and lifted one of the sleeves out with his teeth and chewed at it, gradually taking it in, and all the while opening and closing his eyes in a kind of religious ecstasy, as if he had never tasted anything as good as an overcoat before in his life. Then he smacked his lips once or twice and reached for the other sleeve. Next, he tried the velvet collar and smiled a smile of such contentment, it was plain to see that he regarded that as the daintiest thing about an overcoat. The tails went next, along with some percussion caps and cough candy, and some fig paste from Constantinople. And then my newspaper correspondence dropped out, and he took a chance on that. Manuscript letters written for the home papers. But he was treading on dangerous ground now. He began to come across solid wisdom in those documents that was rather weighty on his stomach. And occasionally he would take a joke that would shake him up till it loosened his teeth. It was getting to be perilous times with him, but he held his grip with good courage and hopefully till at last he began to stumble on statements that were not even a camel could swallow with impunity. He began to gag and gasp, and his eyes stood out, and his forelegs spread, and in about a quarter of a minute he fell over as stiff as a carpenter's workbench and died a death of indescribable agony.
Someone else.
Okay, good. And the iPhone.
This was a letter Mark Twain wrote to, I think it was the daughter of one of his editors, but it's pretty funny.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. So this is to Miss Joy Agnew, who is, I don't know how old she was, probably, you know, like 8 or 9. And, okay, so he says, "Unto you greetings and salutation and worship, you dear, sweet little rightly named Joy. I can see you now almost as vividly as I saw you that night when you were sat flashing and beaming upon those somber swallowtails. Fair as a star when only one is shining in the sky. Oh, you were indeed the only one. There wasn't even the remotest chance of competition with you, dear. You were a decoration, you little witch. The idea of your house going to the wanton expense of a flower garden. Aren't you enough? And what do you want to go, or why do you want to go and discourage the other flowers for? Is that the right spirit? Is it considerate? Is it kind? How do you suppose that they feel when you come around looking the way you look? And so pink and so sweet and dainty and lovely and supernatural. Why, it makes them feel embarrassed and artificial, of course. In my opinion, it is just as pathetic as it can be. Now you want to reform, dear, and do so rightly. Well, certainly you are well off, Joy. 3 bantams, 3 goldfish, 3 doves, 6 canaries, 2 dogs, 1 cat. All you need now to be permanently beyond the reach of want is 1 more dog. Just 1 more good, gentle, high-principled, affectionate, loyal dog who wouldn't want any nobler service than the golden privilege of lying at your door nights and biting everything that came along. And I am that very one and ready to come at the dropping of a hat. Do you think you could convey my love and thanks to your daddy and Owen Seaman and those others oppressed and downtrodden subjects of yours, you darling small tyrant? On my knees, Mark Twain."
I think that's a very good example of the kind of letters he wrote to the other girls. And you can understand why they would be entertained by a grandpa who did that. Anybody else? Okay, I'll tell a couple of stories. I worked in New York for many years, and there, the home in Hartford, that I don't know if any of you know about the home in Hartford, but it's a big mansion that he had built after he had success and was his family home for 20 years. And he built it to look a little bit like a steamboat, you know, because he had been a pilot on the steamboats in Mississippi. And it was rather extravagant, and he actually put the servants' quarters out by the street with a balcony there so that when they wanted to watch parades that went by, they wouldn't have to tip the house over. They could just go out on their side. So there were a lot of things like that, but I'd been there many times. But I had a meeting in Boston one time for business, and on my way back, driving back, I stopped at the Hartford Home, but it was already after hours, and it was, you know, shut down. So it must have been about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, I think a summer night. It was pretty warm. And so I got there, and I was just walking around the grounds, and there was a homeless man sleeping on the porch. He hadn't started sleeping yet, but, you know, he was bedding down for the night on the porch of Mark Twain's home. And so I chatted with him a little bit. And after we chatted for a couple of minutes, he said, "Would you like a tour?" And I said, "Sure." And so he gave me a tour of Mark Twain's home from the outside, not the inside, but from the outside, with all kinds of details he knew about Mark Twain and so on and so forth, and as if he was the possessor of this house. And he made some very interesting comments. For example, you see right here over the door, this is a very fancy woodwork here, and you know, it kind of goes along the way, but over here, they used a little cheaper material and stuff like that because they must have been running out of money. That was a homeless man telling me that. I won't give any other details, but it was one of the more charming times and tours I ever had of the Mark Twain home because this man considered it his own. I don't know how often he lived there, but he told me he lived on the porch quite often. But he had studied all these details and had taken it in as his own. I think that's a great tribute to Mark Twain, actually, in many ways. Another thing is when I visited Elmira, I stopped in Elmira when I was working in New York as an attorney, a young attorney, and I had a deal that was going on between some Dutch clients were buying the use of the Sears name in Brazil. So there was Chicago, there was Holland, there was Amsterdam, and there was Rio de Janeiro involved in the conversations. And I wanted to get away for the weekend because I had made plans to go to Elmira and to go to Niagara Falls after that with my wife, who had never been to either one, of course. So we finally decided to get away, but this deal became very, very intense. And as I was leaving, they said, "Well, we need to send you something tomorrow on Saturday." And I said, "Well, no, I'm going to be traveling." So, well, you know, and this was well before the internet. And so they said, "Well, we'll FedEx something to you. Where are you going to be?" I said, "Well, I'll be in Elmira tomorrow." So they FedExed something to me in Elmira. That was the first stop. So we went to Elmira, and we went to the different Twain things there, and then we headed up to Niagara Falls. And when I got to Niagara Falls, they said, "Well, you know, they called me and said, "Well, we need your comments on the documents that we sent you yesterday," and it was Sunday. This is the life of a New York attorney. And so we were at Niagara Falls, and I get this call, and they said, "You know, I have to call." They didn't have cell phones. I had to call back on something else. I don't remember. It was, you know, I got call, something I had to check to call in at my office, maybe to check up on what was happening. So I checked up, and they had a call set up for 2 o'clock that afternoon, and I had to go, and it was like 1:55. And I had to go to a public phone not far from the falls. I could hear the falls in the background. And for 2 hours on that public phone, I talked to people from Amsterdam, Brazil, and Chicago about these documents while Niagara Falls was going in the background. My wife was cooling her heels patiently. but that was my trip to Elmira. And they had a musical theater in Elmira putting on a performance about some of Mark Twain's work. Somebody had come up with something. Yes?
I wondered if you could comment on the earlier reading from Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn that I thought I heard that he was the first American writer to really write in that informal dialogue.
Yeah. He was. He wanted to write as we speak, and he studied dialect. One of the comments he has in the front, he wrote a letter, I think, to the printer or something like that, and he said, "If it looks like I've spelled words incorrectly, don't touch them." You know, I've done this on purpose. So he had trouble getting it in correctly. And I see that we're at the end of the hour, but I want to put in, but I want to say one thing to go back to my theme, that he was not an angry old man. It's from Mysterious Stranger, which, you know, ironically, was often listed as one of his four top books for quite a while, although it's not very well known anymore or not read very well by the children. Maybe the adults finally read the last chapter. the story is about a boy named, I don't remember what the boy changes. I think his name is Theodore in this version. There's a couple of versions, and actually There's a scholarly work that shows that the biography, this was published in 1916, 6 years after he died, and he put together a couple of other stories that he had been working on but never finished, and put the ending from one on the other one. But, you know, that's, I don't think, going to irritate Twain, because I think he got across the idea that he wanted to, which is very simple. He had this guy grow up in a village in Austria. Theodore was in a village in Austria in the 1400s or something like that. And a new boy came to town. His name was Satan. But he was a grandnephew of the real Satan. But he was the little devil. But he made a lot of magic, and a lot of things happened. And it was a very entertaining little romp. It was sort of like a devilish version of Huckleberry Finn, and Theodore was the Tom Sawyer character. And they went through all these adventures, and this is the way he ends the story. For as much as a year, Satan continued these visits. But at last he came less often, and then for a long time he did not come at all. This always made me lonely and melancholy. I felt that he was losing interest in our tiny world. There's a lot of stuff about how the earth is just one thing out of billions, which was one of the things that fascinated Twain at the time. And might at any time abandon his visits entirely. When one day he finally came to me, I was overjoyed, but only for a little while. He had come to say goodbye, he told me, and for the last time. He had investigations and undertakings in other corners of the universe, he said, that would keep him busy for a longer period than I could wait for his return. And you are going away and will not come back anymore? Yes, Satan said. We have comraded long together, and it has been pleasant. Pleasant for both, but I must go now, and we shall not see each other anymore. In this life, Satan, but in another, shall we meet in another, surely? Then all tranquilly and soberly, he made the strange answer, there is no other. A subtle influence blew upon my spirit from his, bringing with it a vague, dim, but blessed and hopeful feeling that the incredible words might be true, even must be true. Have you never suspected this, Theodore? Satan said. Well, no, how could I? But if it can only be true, it is true. A gust of thankfulness rose in my breast, but a doubt checked it before I could issue it in words. And I said, but we have seen that future life. Earlier in the story, he goes into the future. Satan goes into the future with him. So, but we've seen that future life. How can it not exist? Well, it was a vision. It had no existence. I could hardly breathe for the great hope that was struggling in me. A vision? Life itself is only a vision, only a dream. It was electrical. By God, I had had that very thought 1,000 times in my musing. Nothing exists. All is a dream, Satan said. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, a dream. All a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists except empty space and you. Me? And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am but a dream. I'm your dream, a creature of your own imagination. In a moment you will have realized this. Then you will banish me from your visions, and I shall dissolve into the nothingness out of which you made me. I am perishing already. I am failing. I am passing away. In a little while you will be alone in shoreless space to wander its limitless solitudes without friend or comrade forever. For you will remain a thought, the only existent thought, and by your nature inextinguishable, indestructible. But I, your poor servant, have revealed you to yourself and set you free. Dream other dreams and better. So that's the determinism versus free will. And what he's saying is, to God or the one thing that exists, do a better job next time. Dream better. And he never really came to a conclusion on this. He sometimes thought everything was a dream and it was an illusion and so on and so forth, but other times, no, it's very real and free. You know, so he was going back and forth, but he was not able, even when he was dead set on determinism, to not say, dream better dreams. Dream better dreams. That is free will. So I thought I would end with that. Thank you very much for coming, and another century will come back. So, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.